Heard Mr. Lane from the Singoil saying to his diesel mechanic.
I reckon it was Lamar Sands. You remember he caught his wife doing a number with Chase right on the deck of his fancy ski boat. There's motive, and Lamar's had other run-ins with the law.
What run-ins?
He was with that bunch that slit the sheriff's tires. They were just kids back then. There was something else, too. I just can't remember.
Behind the counter, owner cook Jimbo Sweeney darted from flipping crab cakes on the griddle to stirring a pot of creamed corn on the burner to poking chicken thighs in the deep fryer, then back again, putting piled high plates in front of customers in between. People said he could mix biscuit dough with one hand while filleting a catfish with the other. He offered up his famous specialty, grilled flounder stuffed with shrimp served on pimento cheese grits only a few times a year. No advertising needed. Word got out. As the sheriff and deputy wove among the tables toward the counter, they heard Miss Pansy Price of Cress's Five and Dime say to a friend,
"It could have been that woman lives out in the marsh. Crazy enough for the loony bin. I just bet she'd be up to this kind of thing."
"What do you mean?
What'd she have to do with anything?" "Well, for a while there, she got herself involved with..."
As the sheriff and deputy stepped up to the counter, Ed said,
"Let's just order takeout, poor boys, and get out of here. We can't get dragged into all this."
Chapter 9, Jumpin', 1953. Sitting in the bow, Kaya watched low fingers of fog reaching for their boat. At first, torn-off cloud bits streamed over their heads, then mist engulfed them in grayness, and there was only the tick, tick, tick of the quiet motor. Minutes later, small splotches of unexpected color formed as the weathered shape of the marina gas station eased into view, as though it and not them was moving. Paw motored in, bumping gently against the dock. She'd only been here once. The owner, an old black man, sprang up from his chair to help them, the reason everybody called him Jumpin'. His white sideburns and salt-and-pepper hair framed a wide, generous face and owl eyes. Tall and spare, he seemed to never stop talking, smiling, or throwing his head back, lips shut tight in his own brand of laugh. He didn't dress in overalls, like most workmen around, but wore an ironed blue button-down shirt, two short dark trousers, and work boots. Not often, but now and then, on the meanest summer days, a tattered straw hat. His gas and bait teetered on its own wobbly wharf. A cable ran from the closest oak on shore, about 40 feet across the backwater, and held on with all its might. Jumpin's great-grandpa had built the wharf and shack of cypress planks way back before anybody could remember, sometime before the Civil War. Three generations had nailed bright metal signs, knee-high grape soda, Royal Crown Cola, Camel filters, and 20 years' worth of North Carolina automobile license plates all over the shack, and that burst of color could be seen from the sea through all but the thickest fog.
"Hello, Mr. Jake. How you doing?" "Well, I woke up on the right side of dirt," Pa answered.
Jumpin' laughed, as if he'd never heard the worn-out phrase.
"You got your little daughter with you and all? That's mighty fine."
Pa nodded. Then, as an afterthought,
"Yep, this here's my daughter, Miss Kaya Clark." "Well, I'm mighty proud to know you, Miss Kaya."
Kaya searched her bare toes, but found no words. Jumpin' wasn't bothered, and kept talking about the good fishing lately. Then he asked Pa,
"Fill her up then, Mr. Jake?" "Yeah, slam her right up to the top."
The men talked weather, fishing, then more weather, till the tank was full.
"Good day to y'all now,"
he said as he tossed off the line. Pa cruised slowly back onto a bright sea, the sun taking less time to devour the fog than it took jumpin' to fill a tank. They chugged around a piney peninsula for several miles to Barkley Cove, where Pa tied to the deeply etched beams of the town wharf. Fishermen busied about, packing fish, tying line.
"I reckon we can get us some restaurant victuals," Pa said,
and led her along the pier toward the Barkley Cove diner. Kaya had never eaten restaurant food, had never set foot inside. Her heart thumped as she brushed dried mud from her way too short overalls and patted down her tangled hair. As Pa opened the door, every customer paused mid-bite. A few men nodded faintly at Pa. The women frowned and turned their heads. One snorted,
"Well, they probably can't read the shirt and shoes required."
Pa motioned for her to sit at a small table overlooking the wharf. She couldn't read the menu, but he told her most of it. And she ordered fried chicken, mashed potatoes, gravy, white-acre peas, and biscuits fluffy as fresh-picked cotton. He had fried shrimp, cheese grits, fried okra, and fried green tomatoes. The waitress put a whole dish of butter pats perched on ice cubes and a basket of cornbread and biscuits on their table, and all the sweet iced tea they could drink. Then they had blackberry cobbler with ice cream for dessert. So full, Kaya thought she might get sick, but figured it'd be worth it. As Pa stood at the cash register paying the bill, Kaya stepped out onto the sidewalk, where the ripe smell of fishing boats hung over the bay. She held a greasy napkin wrapped around the leftover chicken and biscuits. Her overalls pockets were stuffed with packages of saltines, which the waitress had left right on the table for the taking.
"Hi."
Kaya heard a tiny voice behind her and turned to see a girl of about 4 years with blonde ringlets looking up at her. She was dressed in a pale blue frock and reached out her hand. Kaya stared at the little hand. It was puffy soft and maybe the cleanest thing Kaya had ever seen. Never scrubbed with lye soap. Certainly no muscle mud beneath the nails. Then she looked into the girl's eyes, in which she herself was reflected as just another kid. Kaya shifted the napkin to her left hand and extended her right slowly toward the girls.
"Hey there, get away!"
Suddenly, Mrs. Teresa White, wife of the Methodist preacher, rushed from the door of the Buster Brown shoe shop. Barkley Cove served its religion hard-boiled and deep-fried. Tiny as it was, the village supported 4 churches, and those were just for the whites. The blacks had 3 more. Of course, the pastors and preachers, and certainly their wives, enjoyed highly respected positions in the village, always dressing and behaving accordingly. Teresa White often wore pastel skirts and white blouses, matching pumps and purse. Now, she hurried toward her daughter and lifted her in her arms. Stepping away from Kaya, she put the girl back on the sidewalk and squatted next to the child.
"Marilyn, darling, don't go near that girl, you hear me? She's dirty."
Kaya watched the mother run her fingers through the curls. Didn't miss how long they held each other's eyes. A woman came out of the Piggly Wiggly and walked quickly up to them.
"Y'all right, Teresa? What happened here? Was that girl bothering Marilyn?"
"I saw her in time. Thank you, Jenny. I wish those people wouldn't come to town. Look at her. Filthy, plumb nasty. There's that stomach flu going around, and I just know for a fact it came in with them. Last year they brought in that case of measles, and that's serious."
Teresa walked away, clutching the child. Just then, Pa, carrying some beer in a brown paper bag, called behind her,
"What you doing? Come on, we got to get out of here. Tide's going out."
Kaya turned and followed, and as they steered home to the marsh, she saw the curls and eyes of mother and child. Pa still disappeared some, not coming back for several days, but not as often as before. And when he did show up, he didn't collapse in a stupor, but ate a meal and talked some. One night they played gin rummy, he guffawing when she won, and she giggling with her hands over her mouth like a regular girl. Each time Kaya stepped off the porch, she looked down the lane, thinking that even though the wild wisteria was fading with late spring and her mother had left late the previous summer, she might see Ma walking home through the sand, still in her fake alligator heels. Now that she and Pa were fishing and talking, maybe they could try again to be a family. Pa had beat all of them, mostly when he was drunk. He'd be all right for a few days at a time. They would eat chicken stew together. Once they flew a kite on the beach. Then, drink, shout, hit. Details of some of the bouts were sharp in her mind. Once Pa shoved Ma into the kitchen wall, hitting her until she slumped to the floor. Kaya, sobbing for him to quit, touched his arm. He grabbed Kaya by the shoulders, shouted for her to pull down her jeans and underpants, and bent her over the kitchen table. In one smooth, practiced motion, he slid the belt from his pants and whipped her. Of course she remembered the hot pain slicing her bare bottom. But curiously, she recalled the jeans pulled around her skinny ankles in more vivid detail. And Ma crumpled into the corner by the cook stove, crying out. Kaya didn't know what all the fighting was about. But if Ma came back now, when Pa was acting decent, maybe they could start over. Kaya never thought it would be Ma who left and Pa who stayed. But she knew her mother wouldn't leave her forever. If she was out there somewhere in the world, she'd come back. Kaya could still see the full red lips as Ma sang to the radio, and hear her words, "Now listen close to Mr. Orson Welles. He speaks proper like a gentleman. Don't ever say ain't. It isn't even a word." Ma had painted the estuaries and sunsets in oils and watercolors so rich they seemed peeled from the earth. She had brought some art supplies with her and could buy bits and pieces at Cress's Five and Dime. Sometimes, Ma had let Kaya paint her own pictures on brown paper bags from the Piggly Wiggly. In early September of that fishing summer, on one afternoon that paled with heat, Kaya walked to the mailbox at the end of the lane. Leafing through the grocery ads, she stopped dead when she saw a blue envelope addressed in Ma's neat hand. A few sycamore leaves were turning the same shade of yellow as when she left. All that time without a trace, and now a letter. Kaya stared at it, held it to the light, ran her fingers across the slanted, perfect script. Her heart banged against her chest. "Ma's alive, living somewhere else. Why hasn't she come home?" She thought of tearing the letter open, but the only word she could read for sure was her name, and it was not on the envelope. She ran to the shack, but Pa had motored somewhere in the boat. So she propped the letter against the salt shaker on the table where he'd see it. As she boiled black-eyed peas with onions, she kept an eye on the letter lest it disappear. Every few seconds, she ducked to the kitchen window to listen for the boat's whir. Then suddenly, Pa was limp walking up the steps. All courage left her and she dashed past him, hollering that she was going to the outhouse. Supper would be ready soon. She stood inside the smelly latrine, her heart running races to her stomach. Balancing on the wooden bench, she watched through the quarter moon slit in the door, not knowing exactly what she expected. Then the porch door slammed, and she saw Pa walking fast toward the lagoon. He went straight to the boat, a poke in his hand, and motored away. She ran back to the house, into the kitchen, but the letter was gone. She flung open his dresser drawers, rummaged through his closet, searching,
It's mine, too. It's mine as much as yours.
Back in the kitchen, she looked in the trash can and found the letter's ashes, still fringed in blue. With a spoon, she dipped them up and laid them on the table, a little pile of black and blue remains. She picked bit by bit through the garbage. Maybe some words had drifted to the bottom. But there was nothing but traces of cinder clinging to onion skin. She sat at the table, the peas still singing in the pot, and stared at the little mound.
Ma touched these. Maybe Paul tell me what she wrote. Don't be stupid. That's as likely as snow falling in the swamp.
Even the postmark was gone. Now she'd never know where Ma was. She put the ashes in a little bottle and kept it in her cigar box next to her bed. Pa didn't come home that night or the next day, and when he finally did, it was the old drunk who staggered through the door. When she mounted the courage to ask about the letter, he barked,
"It ain't none of your business."
And then,
"She ain't coming back, so you can just forget about that."
Carrying a poke, he shuffled toward the boat.
"That isn't true!"
Kaya hollered at his back, her fists bunched at her sides. She watched him leaving, then shouted at the empty lagoon,
"Ain't isn't even a word!"
Later, she would wonder if she should have opened the letter on her own, not even shown it to Pa. Then she could have saved the words to read someday, and he'd have been better off not knowing them. Pa never took her fishing again. Those warm days were just a thrown-in season, low clouds parting, the sun splashing her world briefly, then closing up dark and tight-fisted again. Kaya couldn't remember how to pray. Was it how you held your hands or how hard you squinted your eyes that mattered?
"Maybe if I pray, Ma and Jody will come home. Even with all the shouting and fussing, that life was better than this lumpy grits."
She sang Miss Snippets of hymns.
"And he walks with me when dew is still on the roses."
All she remembered from the little white church where Ma had taken her a few times. Their last visit had been Easter Sunday before Ma left. But all Kaya remembered about the holiday was shouting and blood. Somebody falling, she and Ma running. So she dropped the memory altogether. Kaya looked through the trees at Ma's corn and turnip patch. All weeds now. Certainly there were no roses.
"Just forget it. No God's gonna come to this garden."
Chapter 10. Just Grass in the Wind. 1969. Sand keeps secrets better than mud. The sheriff parked his rig at the beginning of the fire tower lane so they wouldn't drive over any evidence of someone driving the night of the alleged murder. But as they walked along the track, looking for vehicle treads other than their own, sand grains shifted into formless dimples with every step. Then, at the mud holes and swampy areas near the tower, a profusion of detailed stories revealed themselves. A raccoon with her four young had trailed in and out of the muck. A snail had woven a lacy pattern interrupted by the arrival of a bear. And a small turtle had lain in the cool mud, its belly forming a smooth, shallow bowl.
"Clear as a picture, but besides our rigs, not a thing man-made."
"I don't know," Joe said. "See this straight edge, then a little triangle? That could be a tread."
"No, I think that's a bit of turkey print, where a deer stepped on top. Made it look geometrical like that."
After another quarter hour, the sheriff said,
"Let's hike out to that little bay. See if somebody boated over here instead of coming by truck."
Pushing pungent myrtle from their faces, they walked to the tiny inlet. The damp sand revealed prints of crabs, herons, and pipers, but no humans.
Well, but look at this. Joe pointed to a large pattern of disturbed sand crystals that fanned into an almost perfect half-circle. Could be the imprint of a round-bowed boat that was pulled on shore. No, see where the wind blew this broken grass stalk back and forth through the sand, drawing this half-circle? That's just grass in the wind.
They stood looking around. The rest of the small half-moon beach was covered in a thick layer of broken shells, a jumble of crustacean parts and crab claws. Shells, the best secret keepers of all. Chapter 11. Croaker Sacks Full. 1956. In the winter of 1956, when Kaya was 10, Pa came hobbling to the shack less and less often. Weeks passed with no whiskey bottle on the floor, no body sprawled on the bed, no Monday money. She kept expecting to see him limping through the trees, toting his poke. One full moon, then another had passed since she'd seen him. Sycamore and hickories stretched naked limbs against a dull sky, and the relentless wind sucked any joy the winter sun might have spread across the bleakness. A useless drying wind in a sea land that couldn't dry. Sitting on the front steps, she thought about it. A poker game fight could have ended with him beat up and dumped in the swamp on a cold rainy night. Or maybe he just got fall down drunk, wandered off into the woods and fell face first in the backwater bog. I guess he's gone for good. She bit her lips until her mouth turned white. It wasn't like the pain when Ma left. In fact, she struggled to mourn him at all. But being completely alone was a feeling so vast it echoed, and the authorities were sure to find out and take her away. She'd have to pretend, even to jump in, that Pa was still around. And there would be no Monday money. She'd stretched the last few dollars for weeks, surviving on grits, boiled mussels, and the occasional remnant egg from the rangy hens. The only remaining supplies were a few matches, a nubbin of soap, and a handful of grits. A fistful of blue tips wouldn't make a winter. Without them, she couldn't boil the grits, which she fixed for herself, the gulls, and the chickens.
I don't know how to do life without grits.
At least, she thought, wherever Pa had disappeared to this time, he had gone on foot. Kaya had the boat. Of course, she'd have to find another way to get food. But for right now, she pushed the thought to a far corner of her mind. After a supper of boiled mussels, which she had learned to smash into a paste and spread on soda crackers, she thumbed through Ma's beloved books, play-reading the fairy tales. Even at 10, she still couldn't read. Then the kerosene light flickered, faded, and died. 1 minute there was a soft circle of a world, and then darkness. She made an O sound. Pa had always bought the kerosene and filled the lamp, so she hadn't thought much about it. Until it was dark. She sat for a few seconds, trying to squeeze light from the leftovers, but there was almost nothing. Then the rounded hump of the frigid air and the window frame began to take shape in the dimness. So she touched her fingers along the countertop until she found a candle stub. Lighting it would take a match, and there were only 5 left. But darkness was a right now thing. Swish. She struck the match, lit the candle, and the blackness retreated to the corners. But she'd seen enough of it to know she had to have light, and kerosene cost money. She opened her mouth in a shallow pant.
Maybe I ought to walk to town and turn myself into the authorities. At least they'd give me food and send me to school.
But after thinking a minute, she said,
No, I can't leave the gulls, the heron, the shack. The marsh is all the family I got.
Sitting in the last of the candlelight, she had an idea. Earlier than usual, She got up the next morning when the tide was low, pulled on her overalls, and slipped out with a bucket, claw knife, and empty toe bags. Squatting in mud, she collected muscles along the sloughs like Ma had taught her, and in 4 hours of crouching and kneeling had 2 croaker sacks full. The slow sun pulled from the sea as she motored through dense fog up to Jumpin's Gas and Bait. He stood as she neared.
"Hello, Miss Kaya. You wantin' some gas?"
She tucked her head. Hadn't spoken a word to anyone since her last trip to the Piggly Wiggly, and her speech was slipping some.
"Maybe gas. But that depends. I hear tell you buy mussels, and I got some here. Can you pay me cash money and some gas throwed in?"
She pointed to the bags.
"Yes, sirree, you sure do. They fresh?"
"I dug 'em 'fore dawn, just now."
"Well, then, I can give you 50 cents for one bag, a full tank for the other."
Kaya smiled slightly. Real money she made herself.
"Thank you,"
was all she said. As Jumpin' filled the tank, Kaya walked into his tiny store there on the wharf. She'd never paid it much mind because she shopped at the Piggly. But now she saw that besides bait and tobacco, he sold matches, lard, soap, sardines, Vienna sausages, grits, soda crackers, toilet paper, and kerosene. About everything she needed in the world was right here. Lined up on the counter were 5 1-gallon jars filled with penny candy, Red Hots, Jawbreakers, and Sugar Daddies. It seemed like more candy than would be in the world. With the muscle money, she bought matches, a candle, and grits. Kerosene and soap would have to wait for another croaker full. It took all her might not to buy a sugar daddy instead of the candle.
"How many bags you buy a week?" she asked.
"Well now, we striking up a business deal?"
he asked as he laughed in his particular way, mouth closed, head thrown back.
"I buy about 40 pounds every 2-3 days, but mind others bring 'em in too. If you bring 'em in and I already got some, well, you'd be out. It's first come, first serve. No other way of doing it."
"Okay, thank you. That'd be fine. Bye, Jumpin'."
Then she added,
"Oh, by the way, my pa sends his regards to you."
"That's so. Well, then, you do the same from me, if you please. By yourself, Miss Kaya."
He smiled big as she motored away. She almost smiled herself. Buying her own gas and groceries surely made her a grown-up. Later, at the shack, when she unpacked the tiny pile of supplies, she saw a yellow and red surprise at the bottom of the bag. Not too grown-up for a sugar daddy Jumpin' had dropped inside. To stay ahead of the other pickers, Kaya slipped down to the marsh by candle or moon, her shadow wavering around on the glistening sand, and gathered mussels deep in the night. She added oysters to her catch, and sometimes slept near gullies under the stars to get to Jumpin's by first light. The mussel money turned out to be more reliable than the Monday money ever had, and she usually managed to beat out other pickers. She stopped going to the Piggly, where Mrs. Singletary always asked why she wasn't in school. Sooner or later, they'd grab her, drag her in. She got by with her supplies from Jumpin's and had more mussels than she could eat. They weren't that bad tossed into the grits, mashed up beyond recognition. They didn't have eyes to look at her like the fish did. Chapter 12 Pennies and Grits 1956 For weeks after Pa left, Kaya would look up when ravens cawed. Maybe they'd seen him swing-stepping through the woods. At any strange sound in the wind, she cocked her head, listening for somebody. Anybody. Even a mad dash from the truant lady would be good sport. Mostly, she looked for the fishing boy. A few times over the years, she'd seen him in the distance, but hadn't spoken to him since she was 7, 3 years ago when he showed her the way home through the marsh. He was the only soul she knew in the world besides Jumpin' and a few sales ladies. Wherever she glided through the waterways, she scanned for him. One morning, as she motored into a cordgrass estuary, she saw his boat tucked in the reeds. Tate wore a different baseball cap and was taller now, but even from more than 50 yards, she recognized the blonde curls. Kaya idled down, maneuvered quietly into long grass, and peered out at him. Working her lips, she thought of cruising over, maybe asking if he had caught any fish. That seemed to be what Pa and anybody else in the marsh said when they came across somebody.
Anything biting? Had any nibbles?
But she only stared, didn't move. She felt a strong pull toward him and a strong push away, the result being stuck firmly in this spot. Finally, she eased toward home, her heart pushing against her ribs. Every time she saw him, it was the same, watching him as she did the herons. She still collected feathers and shells, but left them, salty and sandy, strewn around the brick and board steps. She dallied some of each day while dishes piled up in the sink, and why wash overalls that got muddied up again? Long ago, she'd taken to wearing the old throwaway overalls from gone-away siblings, her shirts full of holes. She had no more shoes at all. One evening, Kaya slipped the pink and green flowery sundress, the one Ma had worn to church, from the wire hanger. For years now, she had fingered this beauty. The only dress Pa didn't burn. Had touched the little pink flowers. There was a stain across the front, a faded brown splotch under the shoulder straps. Blood, maybe. But it was faint now, scrubbed out like other bad memories. Kaya pulled the dress over her head, down her thin frame. The hem came almost to her toes. That wouldn't do. She pulled it off, hung it up to wait for another few years. It'd be a shame to cut it up, wear it to dig mussels. A few days later, Kaya took the boat over to Point Beach, an apron of white sand several miles south of Jumpin's. Time, waves, and winds had modeled it into an elongated tip, which collected more shells than other beaches, and she had found rare ones there. After securing her boat at the southern end, she strolled north, searching. Suddenly, distant voices, shrill and excited, drifted on the air. Instantly, she ran across the beach toward the woods, where an oak, more than 80 feet from one side to the other, stood knee-deep in tropical ferns. Hiding behind the tree, she watched a band of kids strolling down the sand, now and then dashing around in the waves, kicking up sea spray. One boy ran ahead, another threw a football. Against the white sand, their bright Madras shorts looked like colorful birds and marked the changing season. Summer was walking toward her down the beach. As they moved closer, she flattened herself against the oak and peered around. 5 girls and 4 boys, a bit older than she, maybe 12. She recognized Chase Andrews throwing the ball to those boys he was always with. The girls, tall, skinny blonde, ponytail freckle face, short black hair, always wears pearls and round chubby cheeks, hung back in a little covey, walking slower, chattering and giggling. Their voices lifted up to Kaya like chimes. She was too young to care much about the boys, her eyes fixed on the troop of girls. Together, they squatted to watch a crab skittering sideways across the sand. Laughing, they leaned against one another's shoulders until they flopped on the sand in a bundle. Kaya bit her bottom lip as she watched, wondering how it would feel to be among them. Their joy created an aura almost visible against the deepening sky. Ma had said women need one another more than they need men, but she never told her how to get inside the pride. Easily, she slipped deeper into the forest and watched from behind the giant ferns until the kids wandered back down the beach, until they were little spots on the sand, the way they came. Dawn smoldered beneath gray clouds as Kaya pulled up to Jumpin's Wharf. He walked out of the little shop, shaking his head.
"I'm sorry as can be, Miss Kaya," he said, "but they beat you to it. I got my week's quota of mussels. Can't buy no more."
She cut the engine, and the boat banged against a piling. This was the second week she'd been beat out. Her money was gone, and she couldn't buy a single thing, down to pennies and grits.
"Miss Kaya, you got to find some other way to bring cash in. You can't get all your coons up one tree."
Back at her place, she sat pondering on the brick and boards and came up with another idea. She fished for 8 hours straight, then soaked her catch of 20 in saltwater brine through the night. At daybreak, she lined them up on the shelves of Pa's old smokehouse, the size and shape of an outhouse, built a fire in the pit, and poked green sticks into the flames like he'd done. Blue-gray smoke billowed and puffed up the chimney and through every crack in the walls, the whole shack huffing. The next day, she motored to Jumpin's and, still standing in her boat, held up her bucket. In all, it was a pitiful display of small bream and carp, falling apart at the seams.
"You buy smoked fish, Jumpin'? I got some here."
"Well, I declare you sure did, Miss Kaya. Tell you what, I'll take 'em on consignment, like. If I sell 'em, you get the money. If I don't, you get 'em back like they is. That do?"
"Okay. Thanks, Jumpin'."
That evening, Jumpin' walked down the sandy tract to Colored Town, a cluster of shacks and lean-tos, and even a few real houses squatting about on backwater bogs and mudsloughs. The scattered encampment was in deep woods, back from the sea with no breeze, and more mosquitoes than the whole state of Georgia. After about 3 miles, he could smell the smoke from cook fires drifting through the pines, and hear the chatter of some of his grandchildren. There were no roads in Colored Town, just trails leading off through the woods this way and that to different family dwellings. His was a real house he and his pa had built with pine lumber and a raw wood fence around the hardpan dirt yard, which Mabel, his good-sized wife, swept clean as a whistle just like a floor. No snake could slink within 30 yards of the steps without being spotted by her hoe. She came out of the house to meet him with a smile, as she often did, and he handed her the pail with Kaya's smoked fish.
"What's this?" she asked. "Looks like something even dogs wouldn't drag in." "It's that girl again. Miss Kaya brung 'em. Sometimes she ain't the first one with muscles, so she's gone to smoking fish. Wants me to sell 'em." "Lord, we got to do something about that child. Ain't nobody gonna buy them fish. I can cook 'em up in stew. Our church can come up with some clothes, other things for her. We'll tell her there's some family that'll trade jumpers for carpies. What size is she?" "You asking me? Skinny. All's I know is she's skinny as a tick on a flagpole. I expect she'll be there first thing in the morning. She's plumb broke."
After eating a breakfast of warmed-up mussels and grits, Kaya motored over to Jumpin's to see if any money'd come in from the smoked fish. In all these years, it had just been him there, or customers, but as she approached slowly, she saw a large black woman sweeping the wharf like it was a kitchen floor. Jumpin' was sitting in his chair, leaning back against the store wall doing figures in his ledger. Seeing her, he jumped up, waved.
"Good morning,"
she called quietly, drifting expertly up to the dock.
Hiya, Miss Kaya. Got somebody here for you to meet. This here's my wife, Mabel.
Mabel walked up and stood next to Jumpin', so that when Kaya stepped onto the wharf, they were close. Mabel reached out and took Kaya's hand, held it gently in hers, and said,
It's mighty fine to meet you, Miss Kaya. Jumpin's told me what a fine girl you are, one of the best oyster pickers.
In spite of hoeing her garden, cooking half of every day, and scrubbing and mending for whites, Mabel's hand was supple. Kaya kept her fingers in that velvet glove, but didn't know what to say, so stood quiet.
Now, Miss Kaya, we got a family who'll trade clothes and other stuff you need for your smoked fish.
Kaya nodded, smiled at her feet, then asked,
What about gas for my boat?
Mabel turned question eyes at Jumpin'.
Well, now, he said, I'll give you some today, 'cause I know you're short. But you keep bringing in mussels and such when you can.
Mabel said in her big voice,
Lord, child, let's don't worry none about the details. Now let me look at you. I gotta calculate your size to tell 'em.
She led her into the tiny shop.
Let's sit right here, and you tell me what clothes and what all else you need.
After they discussed the list, Mabel traced Kaya's feet on a piece of brown paper bag, then said,
Well, come back tomorrow, and there'll be a stack here for you.
I'm much obliged, Mabel.
Then, her voice low, said,
There's something else. I found these old packages of seeds, but I don't know about gardening.
Well, now?
Mabel leaned back and laughed deep in her generous bosom.
I can sure do a garden.
She went over every step in great detail, then reached into some cans on the shelf and brought out squash, tomato, and pumpkin seeds. She folded each kind into some paper and drew a picture of the vegetable on the outside. Kaya didn't know if Mabel did this because she couldn't write or because she knew Kaya couldn't read, but it worked fine for both of them. She thanked them as she stepped into her boat.
I'm glad to help you, Miss Kaya. Now come back tomorrow for your things,
Mabel said. That very afternoon, Kaya started hoeing the rows where Ma's garden used to be. The hoe made clunking sounds as it moved down the rows, releasing earthy smells and uprooting pinkish worms. Then a different clink sounded, and Kaya bent to uncover one of Ma's old metal and plastic barrettes. She swiped it gently against her overalls until all the grit fell clear. As if reflected in the cheap artifact, Ma's red mouth and dark eyes were clearer than they'd been in years. Kaya looked around. Surely Ma was walking up the lane even now, come to help turn this earth. Finally home. Such stillness was rare. Even the crows were quiet, and she could hear her own breathing. Sweeping up bunches of her hair, she pinned the barrette above her left ear. Maybe Ma was never coming home. Maybe some dreams should just fade away. She lifted the hoe and clobbered a chunk of hard clay into smithereens. When Kaya motored up to Jumpin's wharf the next morning, he was alone. Perhaps the large form of his wife and her fine ideas had been an illusion. But there, sitting on the wharf, were two boxes of goods that Jumpin' was pointing to, a wide grin on his face.
Good morning, Miss Kaya. This here's for you.
Kaya jumped onto the wharf and stared at the overflowing crates.
Go on, then, Jumpin' said. It's all yourn.
Gently, she pulled out overalls, jeans, and real blouses, not just t-shirts. A pair of navy blue lace-up Keds and some Buster Brown two-tone saddle shoes, polished brown and white so many times they glowed. Kaya held up a white blouse with a lace collar and a blue satin bow at the neck. Her mouth opened a little bit. The other box had matches, grits, a tub of oleo, dried beans, and a whole quart of homemade lard. On top, wrapped in newspaper, were fresh turnips and greens, rutabagas and okra.
"Jumpin'," she said softly. "This is more than those fish would have cost. This could be a month's fish."
"Well, now, what are folks gonna do with old clothes laying around the house? If they got these things extra and you need 'em and you got fish and they need fish, then that's the deal. You gotta take 'em now, 'cause I ain't got room for that junk round here."
Kaya knew that was true. Jumpin' had no extra space, so she'd be doing him a favor to take them off his wharf.
"I'll take 'em then. But you tell him thank you, will you? And I'll smoke more fish and bring it in soon as I can."
"Okay then, Miss Kaya. That'll be fine. You bring in fish when you get 'em."
Kaya chugged back into the sea. Once she rounded the peninsula, out of sight of Jumpin's, she idled down, dug in the box, and pulled out the blouse with the lace collar. She put it on right over her scratchy bib overalls with patched knees and tied the little satin ribbon into a bow at her neck. Then, one hand on the tiller, the other on lace, she glided across ocean and estuaries toward home. Chapter 13. Feathers. 1960. Lanky, yet brawny for 14, Kaya stood on an afternoon beach, flinging crumbs to gulls. Still couldn't count them. Still couldn't read. No longer did she daydream of winging with eagles. Perhaps when you have to paw your supper from mud, imagination flattens to that of adulthood. Ma's sundress fit snugly across her breasts and fell just below her knees. She reckoned she had caught up and then some. She walked back to the shack, got a pole and line, and went straight to fishing from a thicket on the far side of her lagoon. Just as she cast, a stick snapped behind her. She jerked her head around, searching. A footfall in brush. Not a bear, whose large paws squished in debris, but a solid clunk in the brambles. Then the crows cawed. Crows can't keep secrets any better than mud. Once they see something curious in the forest, they have to tell everybody. Those who listen are rewarded, either warned of predators or alerted to food. Kaya knew something was up. She pulled in the line, wrapped it around the pole even as she pushed silently through the brush with her shoulders. Stopped again. Listened. A dark clearing, one of her favorite places, spread cavern-like under five oaks so dense, only hazy streams of sunlight filtered through the canopy, striking lush patches of trillium and white violets. Her eyes scanned the clearing but saw no one. Then a shape slunk through a thicket beyond, and her eyes swung there. It stopped. Her heart pumped harder. She hunkered down, stoop running fast and quiet into the undergrowth on the edge of the clearing. Looking back through the branches, she saw an older boy walking fast through the woods, his head moving to and fro. He stopped as he saw her. Kaya ducked behind a thorn bush, then squeezed into a rabbit run that twisted through brambles thick as a fort wall. Still bent, she scrambled, scratching her arms on prickly scrub, paused again, listening. Hid there in burning heat, her throat racking from thirst. After 10 minutes, no one came, so she crept to a spring that pooled in moss and drank like a deer. She wondered who that boy was and why he'd come.
That was the thing about going to Jumpin's. People saw her there. Like the underbelly of a porcupine, she was exposed. Finally, between dusk and dark, that time when the shadows were unsure, she walked back toward the shack by way of the oak clearing.
"'Cause of him sneaking round, I didn't catch any fish to smoke."
In the center of the clearing was a rotted-down stump, so carpeted in moss it looked like an old man hiding under a cape. Kaya approached it, then stopped. Lodged in the stump and sticking straight up was a thin black feather about 5 or 6 inches long. To most, it would have looked ordinary, maybe a crow's wing feather. But she knew it was extraordinary, for it was the eyebrow of a great blue heron, the feather that bows gracefully above the eye, extending back beyond her elegant head. One of the most exquisite fragments of the coastal marsh, right here. She had never found one, but knew instantly what it was, having squatted eye to eye with herons all her life. A great blue heron is the color of gray mist reflecting in blue water, and like mist, she can fade into the backdrop, all of her disappearing except the concentric circles of her lock and load eyes. She is a patient, solitary hunter, standing alone as long as it takes to snatch her prey. Or, eyeing her catch, she will stride forward one slow step at a time, like a predacious bridesmaid. And yet, on rare occasions, she hunts on the wing, darting and diving sharply, sword-like beak in the lead.
How'd it get stuck straight up in the stump?
Whispering, Kaya looked around.
That boy must have put it here. He could be watching me right now.
She stood still, heart pounding again. Backing away, she left the feather and ran to the shack and locked the screen door, which she seldom did since it offered scant protection. Yet as soon as dawn crept between the trees, she felt a strong pull toward the feather, at least to look at it again. At sunrise, she ran to the clearing, looked around carefully, then walked to the stump and lifted the feather. It was sleek, almost velvety. Back at the shack, she found a special place for it in the center of her collection, from tiny hummingbird feathers to large eagle tails that winged across the wall. She wondered why a boy would bring her a feather. The next morning, Kaya wanted to rush to the stump to see if another one had been left. But she made herself wait. She must not run into the boy. Finally, in late morning, she walked to the clearing, approaching slowly, listening. She didn't hear or see anybody, so she stepped forward. And a rare, brief smile lit her face when she saw a thin white feather stuck into the top of the stump. It reached from her fingertips to her elbow and curved gracefully to a slender point. She lifted it and laughed out loud. A magnificent tail feather of a tropic bird. She'd never seen these seabirds because they didn't occur in this region, but on rare occasions they were blown over land on hurricane wings. Kaya's heart filled with wonder that someone had such a collection of rare feathers that he could spare this one. Since she couldn't read Ma's old guidebook, she didn't know the names for most of the birds or insects, so made up her own. And even though she couldn't write, Kaya had found a way to label her specimens. Her talent had matured, and now she could draw, paint, and sketch anything. Using chalks or watercolors from the five and dime, she sketched the birds, insects, or shells on grocery bags and attached them to her samples. That night, she splurged and lit 2 candles and set them in saucers on the kitchen table so she could see all the colors of the white, so she could paint the tropic bird feather. For more than a week, there was no feather on the stump. Kaya went by several times a day, cautiously peeping through ferns, but saw nothing.
She sat in the cabin in midday, something she rarely did. Should have soaked beans for supper. Now it's too late.
She walked through the kitchen, rummaging through the cupboard, drumming her fingers on the table. Thought of painting, but didn't. Walked again to the stump. Even from some distance, she could see a long striped tail feather of a wild turkey. It caught her up. Turkeys had been one of her favorites. She'd watched as many as 12 chicks tuck themselves under the mother's wings, even as the hen walked along, a few tumbling out of the back, then scrambling to catch up. But about a year ago, as Kaya strolled through a stand of pines, she'd heard a high-pitched shriek. A flock of 15 wild turkeys, mostly hens, a few toms and jakes, rushed about, pecking what looked like an oily rag crumpled in the dirt. Dust stirred from their feet and shrouded the woods, drifting up through branches, caught there. As Kaya had crept closer, she saw it was a hen turkey on the ground, and the birds of her own flock were pecking and toe-scratching her neck and head. Somehow, she'd managed to get her wings so tangled with briars, her feathers stuck out at strange angles and she could no longer fly. Jody had said that if a bird becomes different from the others, disfigured or wounded, it is more likely to attract a predator. So the rest of the flock will kill it, which is better than drawing in an eagle who might take one of them in the bargain. A large female clawed at the bedraggled hen with her large horny feet, then pinned her to the ground as another female jabbed at her naked neck and head. The hen squealed, looking around with wild eyes at her own flock assaulting her. Kaya ran into the clearing, throwing her arms around.
Hey, what you doing? Get out of here! Stop it!
The flurry of wings kicked up more dust as the turkeys scattered into brush, two of them flying heavy into an oak. But Kaya was too late. The hen, her eyes wide open, lay limp. Blood ran from her wrinkled neck, bent crooked on the dirt.
Shoo! Go on!
Kaya chased the last of the large birds until they shuffled away, their business complete. She knelt next to the dead hen and covered the bird's eye with a sycamore leaf. That night, after watching the turkeys, she ate a supper of leftover cornbread and beans, then lay on her porch bed, watching the moon touch the lagoon. Suddenly, she heard voices in the woods coming toward the shack. They sounded nervous, squeaky, boys, not men. She sat straight up. There was no back door. It was get out now or still be sitting on the bed when they came. Quick as a mouse, she slipped to the door, but just then candles appeared, moving up and down, their light jiggling in halos, too late to run. The voices got louder.
Here we come, Marsh girl! Hey, in there? Miss Missing Link? Show us your teeth. Show us your swamp grass.
Peals of laughter. She ducked lower behind the half wall of the porch as the footsteps moved closer. The flames flickered madly, then went out altogether as 5 boys, maybe 13 or 14 years old, ran across the yard. All talking stopped as they galloped full speed to the porch and tagged the door with their palms, making slapping sounds. Every smack a stab in the turkey hen's heart. Against the wall, Kaya wanted to whimper but held her breath. They could break through the door easy. One hard yank and they'd be in. But they backed down the steps, ran into the trees again, hooting and hollering with relief that they had survived the marsh girl, the wolf child, the girl who couldn't spell dog. Their words and laughter carried back to her through the forest as they disappeared into the night. Back to safety. She watched the relit candles bobbing through the trees, then sat staring into the stone-quiet darkness, shamed. Kaya thought of that day and night whenever she saw wild turkeys. but she was thrilled to see the tail feather on the stump. Just to know, the game was still on. Chapter 14. Red Fibers.